All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And yes, I'm talking in a clipped manner today because that song, I was just going to lean over to Teddy and say, hey, yo, let's just play that song through the entire show. But we're not going to do that because there's too much important that we got to talk about. All right, at the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with Stephanie LaCambra, who's a criminal defense attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and we're talking about the prosecution of the Inauguration Day, or J20, defendants, people arrested protesting the inauguration of Trump and the unconstitutional methods that the prosecution is using. Before that, we'll be listening to a conversation I had with Catherine Hayhoe, an atmospheric scientist and associate professor of political science at Texas Tech University, and she's the director of its Climate Science Center. We're going to be talking about, she was one of the lead authors of the National Climate Assessment and all the stuff that's been going on around that, okay? And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Carl Dix, and I'm not going to take a long time introducing him because we got a lot of serious stuff to talk about right now. Carl recently, you know, he's a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and a foreign advocate for Bob Avakian. And he's also a co-initiator of Refuse Fascism. And with Cornel West, he co-founded the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And well, let me say this. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Yeah, definitely, man. Well, so much has happened since we last spoke. I mean, if you think about what has been going on in relation to, basically, we're going to focus a lot up around Charlottesville and not lose sight of that, but also that there's bigger, much bigger things going on in relation to that that come right out of that, but also in relation to that overall. And I wanted to talk with you about this because this, I think, came to us a wake-up call. And I'm not sure, it's I think we'll see in the future how effective it has been in terms of, one, you can see the wake-up call to the fascists, but then there's also to people around the country, there's been a call put out objectively that they need to stand up and stand up against this and take a serious look at what the hell is going on under this fascist in the White House and what it means for people, what people have to do. So I wanted to talk with you. You've been down in Charlottesville, and I wanted to talk to you. You were there during all this stuff that happened. Let's talk about what actually did happen in Charlottesville last weekend.
Yeah, look, what happened in Charlottesville last weekend is that white supremacists descended on the city displaying Confederate flags and Nazi banners, armed to the teeth, everything from shields, pipes, clubs, and even a lot of them had guns, and they spewed white supremacist, KKK, and Nazi slogans, just racist poison everywhere they went. I was told a number of times, we're starting the ovens up for you. And not just me individually, but every black person who got within hearing range heard this, as well as anybody that they thought looked Jewish or LGBTQ. And then a number of women heard the same thing if they dared to get in the face of these old and new cluckers. And what you're seeing here are shock troops being called forth from the very top because Donald Trump, Mike Pence, their regime is creating the atmosphere that's whipping this up. And they're aiming to weld these forces into shock troops for hammering fascism into place. And that's what you saw on one side in Charlottesville. And then on the other side, you saw a diverse array of people who were like, this could not go down unchallenged. And it was very important that there was the level of resistance that there was. And it was heroic resistance because you were putting your life on the line by going there to confront these white supremacists and the racist poison that they were spewing out. And if you didn't know that before you got there, it became clear once you got there, when you looked at what they were displaying, carrying, and the way in which they launched unprovoked physical attacks, trying to beat down people across the city. Anybody who looks at video of this could see that. And then one of them even murdered Heather Heyer, drove his car into a crowd of people, killing her and injuring 19 other people. This is what they were out to do. They're serious, they're determined, and they're organized. And Donald Trump had their back in the days afterwards, you know, saying this thing about there were violence and bigotry on many sides. And then when pressed in the press conference he was doing Tuesday, came out and openly said, you're talking about the alt-right. What about the alt-left? This made-up term that some of these forces are coming up with that charged at them. Both sides were violent, but the rightists, these white supremacists, had a permit, and those protesting their white supremacy didn't. So, in other words, the white supremacists were legitimate in Donald Trump's mind, and those protesting white supremacy were illegitimate.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I have to ask you about this, and I think it's important that we speak to this a little bit early in the interview, because I don't want to let it go by, because there is a point where you've talked about the impact of the fascist on things. And then I wanted to ask you what you thought about the impact of basically what Heather Heyer stood for. You know, she was murdered by them, but, you know, listening to her mother talk at the memorial and all this other stuff, there was this real call that was put out, you know, beyond life. It was, you know, she came to that demonstration fearlessly, and I'm sure didn't think, oh, I'm going to get killed, but she basically stood there and stood with the people and stood up against these fascists. And her death actually has not been something that scared people away, but in fact, her mom and many other people have called on people to actually stand up in her shoes and step up to take her place. Let's have a minute about Heather Heyer, okay?
Yes, see, and this is very important, and you know, I'm old enough to go back to the civil rights movement, and I remember in particular Viola Luise. I keep mispronouncing her name. I should get this right. But a woman, a white woman who came down from Michigan, I believe, went to Alabama to stand with the civil rights workers who were working against the subjugation of black people down there, who was murdered by the Ku Klux Klan. And like her, Viola, Heather was that kind of person, someone who came to stand against white supremacist poison that was being put out there. And people have spoken to this again and again in the memorial activity around her, how she couldn't stand to see anyone unfairly treated and came out to Charlottesville last weekend with that same spirit. And everybody who came was putting their life on the line, and her sacrifice kind of concentrates that. And then the fact that the day after there were solidarity actions all across the country was very, very important, because this protest, this Unite the Right rally, was consciously aiming at bringing together various strands of white supremacy active in this country, welding them into literally into fighting for as a message of intimidation. And the response that people have had of stepping up in the face of that's very important, and we have to go build off of it and go beyond it.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things in relation to that, Trump, you know, Trump and his whole assessment of what happened, and the fact that he was like, you know, he started out with, as you mentioned, both sides to blame, and, you know, this outrageous comment about both sides were to blame. There was, you know, people on both sides were doing something wrong. And then he, you know, had this like momentary sort of quiet moment where it was sort of, you know, he had equated the Nazis with the people who came there to fight fascism and to fight all the stuff that was represented by the Nazis. And he equated the two of those two groups. But then also, you know, when he pulled back a minute for that, and then just later in the week, you know, not what, 24 hours later.
24 hours later.
Yeah, the thunder that came out of his mouth about what was going on around, you know, the importance of protecting these statues. And he basically put forward the fascist program and said, we've got to get behind this. And more or less, that's what he was saying. I wanted you to talk about that a little.
Yeah, it sounded like he was speaking from a white supremacist talking points memo, talking about the importance of the history that these Confederate monuments represented. Where do you draw the line? It starts out with Robert E. Lee today, Stonewall Jackson, another Confederate general tomorrow. Where does it go? To Washington and Jefferson next? And saying we have to hold on to this history and this culture and talking about the beauty of these statues that would be lost if they were removed. And first off, nothing beautiful about statues honoring slavery and those who fought for it and the culture that it represents. That all needs to go. But also, this thing of connecting it to Washington and Jefferson, well, he is connecting the legacy of slavery, because here you've got slave owners who were part of the foundation of this country, and that is the history of America. This is an empire that is rooted in the enslavement of African people and the extermination of the native inhabitants. This white supremacy that is surging now was there at the foundation and has coursed through the veins of America all the way through. And that is something that people do need to confront, because we need to get rid of the white supremacy and the patriarchy, the aggressive U.S. national chauvinism that goes along with it. And to do that, you've got to recognize that this is what this country's been founded on. This is what it, not only its legacy rests on, but frankly, the wealth and power rests on that foundation as well. Mm-hmm. And that needs to be brought forward. So we need to go at this regime that has called forth this virulent white supremacy. We need to drive this regime from power. And that's why I say it's important that we recognize we've got the outlines of a civil war here, and one side is very determined, very organized, and has a goal of hammering into place fascism. The other side, there's very broad people who are on the other side. Many of them went into motion around Charlottesville, but we have to get more serious, more organized, and more determined. And there is a way to do that right now, because refusefascism.org has issued a call for people to take to the streets on November 4th to drive this regime from power. And there's regional conferences being held in 5 cities across the country.
Well, let me ask you this, man. I wanted to actually pursue this other piece that you were talking about a little bit, and then I have 2 more questions for you. And one is that, you know, look, as the week went on, I mean, there is a point that, you know, it's striking, you know, when you think about how many presidents have gone up and done similar things to Trump in terms of, like, having their, you know, photo ops at these statues and all these other things. But there's a real difference between what was going on before and what Trump is doing with all this, because he's really calling forth the warriors of fascism, basically. And when you think about this, this week, as the week went on, there was somewhat of an attempt by the news and all these other people to, as Trump started to seem, you know, they were saying he's spinning out of control. They're painting him as he's blundering, he's blustering, he's out of control, and he's on a path of self-destruction. But there's a different reality there, because what he was doing was very intense when you think about who he was speaking to and what he was trying to call forth. And I was reminded of that when you mentioned the point about the outline of a coming civil war. There was something very much connected up with that point about a coming civil war and what Trump was doing in relation to all the statues and what stand he was taking and was he right and all this other stuff early in the middle of the week and on.
Yeah, see, because this is important. I mean, look, Reagan opened up his campaign for the presidency by going to the site where 3 civil rights workers were murdered in Mississippi. And that was not lost on the forces of white supremacy. And every president has served white supremacy here in this country, including Obama. And we could get into that, but don't have the time. But there is something real different with Trump, and it's not his personal peculiarities. It is that he is hammering into place a fascist regime. And for that, no more dog whistles, no more enforcing policies with some hypocrisy about standing for diversity and equality. He is calling them forth with a bugle, speaking like he's talking from their memos, because this is what's required to hammer into place this kind of open, naked dictatorship, which is what a section of the folks who run this country think they need to keep their empire in effect. And this is something that people have to get, and we have to get organized to take this on and stop this regime, drive it from power before it's too late. You know, because a lot of people know the one quote from Niemöller about first they came for the communists but I didn't do anything because I wasn't a communist, on down to the different groups until there was no one left to stand. There's another important quote from Pastor Niemöller from Germany, and I don't remember the exact quote, but he basically says, if we had stood up right at the beginning with backbone and determination to drive this regime out, we would have suffered some losses. And he quantifies it. I don't remember what numbers, but he said it would have been better for humanity because look at what actually did happen. And we're in the same situation right now. We have a fascist regime moving to hammer its rule in place. And there's a window to stop it, but that window won't be open forever. We have to move to do that and to do that now. And one other thing that I would want to add is that we also have to look at where all this came from. Because, look, this white supremacy, the patriarchy, the aggressive America number one chauvinism, this didn't start with Trump. It way predates him, and it's rooted into the fabric and framework of this capitalist imperialist system. And we need to stop it. We need to eradicate those horrors once and for all, not try to get back to a point where those horrors aren't as grotesque and not as open, less onerous and murderous. We need to get rid of them. And doing that is going to require getting rid of the system through revolution, nothing less. And people need to get into the leadership we have for this revolution in Bob Avakian. And they need to go to the website revcom.us. You can read both his work, Uncovering the Roots of Fascism, in articles like The Right-Wing Conspiracy and The Destruction of the Weimar Republic and How to Go at That, but also dig into the New Communism, the book that he put together that's taken the understanding of how to make revolution and bring a whole different world into being to a level it's never been before. And they can get coverage on things like Charlottesville, like the blustering threats to launch war on North Korea, which is another horror that this regime is bringing down on humanity.
Mm-hmm. All right, Carl Dix, I want to thank you very much. And I want to thank you very much for that last section of it, too, because that's exactly where I was going to ask you to go, because a lot of people are fretting and really seriously thinking about what the hell are we up against and where do we go from here? And what you just brought out is extremely important for people to not just be considering, but to be diving into and looking at it and seeing, you know, do they think it's right or not? And if they think it's right, they need to move. They need to actually move on pursuing what they think is right. So I think that was an extremely important thing you were bringing out to people. The times have got to change.
Exactly.
All right. All right, Carl, thank you very much. And I'm sure we'll be talking to you again very soon.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Okay. Take care, man. All right. This is the Michael Slate Show. And I've been talking with Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and a follower and advocate of Bob Avakian and his new synthesis of communism. Carl is also one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism, and he is also he's a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, along with Cornel West. Right now, we're going to listen to Susan Breaux, the mother of Heather Heyer. People will know that Heather was the young woman who courageously stood up against the Nazis and other white supremacists in Charlottesville on August 12th and was murdered in the course of doing that, murdered by a Nazi, okay? As I said, this is Susan Breaux, Heather's mother, and she's speaking at the memorial for Heather on August 16th, so take a listen.
My child's famous Facebook post was, "If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention." She paid attention. She made a lot of us pay attention. Oh my gosh, dinner with her, we knew it was going to be an ordeal of listening and conversation and perhaps disagreement, but it was going to happen. And so my husband would say, "Okay, I'm going to go out in the car and play on my video game for a while." And we would sit and would grill. And she and I would talk. And I would listen. And we would negotiate. And I would listen. And we talked about all this stuff. We talked about politics. We talked about anything that caught her eye that she felt was fair, unfair. She'd talk about her feelings about the office and how things were going. I mean, she just talked. The girl loved to talk. And she was single, so there was nobody listening at home, so Mama got a lot of it. And that was wonderful. You never think you're going to bury your child. You never think to take those pictures. They asked me for pictures for this, and I struggled. I had pictures from her childhood. But I had to go to Facebook to find pictures of my child because we were always together. I saw her a couple times a month at least, and we would text each other fairly often, and we would Facebook message at bedtime, I love you. I love you. You doing okay? Yep, I love you. So I have no regrets on that part. Take pictures of the ones that you love because you don't know when they're not going to be there. But here's what I want to say to you today. This could be a storm in a teacup, and it could all be for nothing. I could have said, let's don't do this publicly. Let's have a small private funeral. But, you know, that's not who Heather was. Anybody who knew Heather said, yep, this is the way she had to go, big and large. Had to have the world involved because that's my child. She's just that way. Always has been, and she will continue to be. Because here's the message. Although Heather was a caring and compassionate person, so are a lot of you. A lot of you go that extra mile. And I think the reason that what happened to Heather has struck a chord is because we know that what she did is achievable. We don't all have to die. We don't all have to sacrifice our lives. They tried to kill my child to shut her up. Well, guess what? You just magnified her. So here's what I want to happen. You ask me, what can I do? So many caring people, pages of pages of pages of stuff I'm going through. I'm reading pages of pages of pages how she's touching the world. I want this to spread. I don't want this to die. This is just the beginning of Heather's legacy. This is not the end of Heather's legacy. You need to find in your heart that small spark of accountability. What is there that I can do to make the world a better place? What injustice do I see and want to turn away? I don't really want to get involved in that. I don't want to speak up. They'll be annoyed with me. My boss might think less of me. I don't care. You poke that finger at yourself like Heather would have done, and you make it happen. You take that extra step. You find a way to make a difference in the world. My child had a high school education. My child was no saint. She was hard to raise because everything was a negotiation. not kidding, but you know what? She was a firm believer in whatever she believed, and let's do that. Let's find that spark of conviction. Let's find in ourselves that action. Let's spread this. Let's have the uncomfortable dialogue. It ain't easy sitting down and saying, well, why are you upset? It ain't easy sitting down going, yeah, well, I think this way, and I don't agree with you, but I'm going to respectfully listen to what you have to say. We're not going to sit around and shake hands and go kumbaya, and I'm sorry, it's not all about forgiveness. I know that that's not a popular trend. But the truth is, we are going to have our differences. We are going to be angry with each other. But let's channel that anger not into hate, not into violence, not into fear, but let's channel that difference, that anger, into righteous action. Right now, down the road, there's a blood drive going on in Heather's name. Right now, there are people who are here willing to listen to one another and talk to one another. Last night in New England, they had a peaceful rally in Heather's name to have some difficult dialogues. If you ever want to see what one of those dialogues look like, look at her Facebook post. I'm telling you, they were rough sometimes, but they were dialogues, and the conversations have to happen. That's the only way we're going to carry Heather's spark through. So remember in your heart, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. And I want you to pay attention, Find what's wrong. Don't ignore it. Don't look the other way. You make a point to look at it and say to yourself, what can I do to make a difference? And that's how you're going to make my child's death worthwhile. I'd rather have my child, but by golly, if I got to give her up, we're going to make it count.
That was Susan Brough giving a eulogy for her daughter, Heather Heyer, who courageously stood up against the Nazis and other white supremacist scum in Charlottesville, Virginia on August 12th, and she was savagely murdered when one of the Nazis drove a car into the crowd of demonstrators. Since her death, tens of thousands of people have marched in the streets, confronting Nazis wherever they have shown their face, and we need a hell of a lot more of that. Yeah, that's right. Live in the spirit of Heather Heyer. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. Fight the powers that be, all right? Keep that in mind, straight out. Never lose that, never let that get out of your mind. Fight the powers that be, all right? There you go. I just recently had the opportunity to talk with Catherine Hayhoe, who is an atmospheric scientist and associate professor of political science at Texas Tech University. She's the director of its Climate Science Center, and she was one of the lead authors in the National Climate Assessment that actually has given rise to a whole big brouhaha. Yeah, I can't wait to use that word, that phrase, brouhaha, all the time. But it was basically, there was a scandal about the New York Times printed this thing because, as it turns out, they printed it for various reasons, including wanting to make sure that the actual honest version of it got out there and not something that was changed by the Trumpites, okay, as they went and reviewed it to see if it fit their schedule. So without any further ado, I want to give you a chance to listen to my conversation with Catherine Hayhoe. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. Her name is Catherine Hayhoe, and she is an atmospheric scientist who studies climate change, an expert reviewer for the Nobel Peace Prize-winning Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and her life's work has been dedicated to discovering and communicating the realities of a changing climate to all those who will be affected most by it. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Let's jump into this right away. The average temperature in the U.S. has continued to rise over decades, and it's been something that's been going on for quite some time. And in fact, the most recent decades have actually been the warmest years in the past 1,500 years. Now, you've been part of a study that recently uncovered what is happening now and what it means for the planet. Tell us about the report and its findings.
I am a lead author on the new climate science report that we wrote for the federal government. It is an enormous report that looks at how our temperature, our rainfall, our sea level is changing. It also digs into some of the latest findings regarding what's happening up in the Arctic, how our weather patterns are getting weirder, and what's the potential for a big and unpleasant surprise in this completely unprecedented experiment that we're conducting with our planet. But if I had to summarize this entire report in one sentence, I would summarize it like this. Climate is changing. It's us. The risks are real. And the window of time to fix this thing is closing fast.
Well, let's dig into that sentence, because that's a pretty loaded sentence in terms of all that.
Yes, it is. 600 pages of science behind that sentence.
When you talk about it's happening, is it really that bad?
Yeah. I mean, when we talk about how the temperature of the planet has changed by a degree and a half Fahrenheit, or how the temperature in the United States has gone up by about that much, we think that doesn't sound like a lot. I mean, there's probably a bigger difference between the room I'm in right now and the room just outside the door than has happened over the whole planet over decades. The reality, though, is that the temperature of our planet over the course of human civilization on this planet is about as stable as a human body. Just think of what would happen if your temperature, or even worse, your child's temperature, started running consistently a degree and a half above normal. You know, some days it might be a bit lower, some days it might be a bit higher, but over days, weeks, years, you notice, oh my goodness, their temperature is starting to go up and up and up, we would take our child to the doctor. And that's what we've done with our planet. We climate scientists are like the physicians of the planet. We've been tracking this temperature change, and we realize that this is starting to affect us. One of the biggest ways it's affecting you and me, though, is through messing with our local weather patterns. I was waiting to pick up my son the other day from Sunday school, and one of the other parents came up while we were just waiting, and he said, "Can I ask you something?" And I go to a conservative church in West Texas, so when someone says to the climate scientist, "Can I ask you something?" you're always a little bit nervous, but I said, "Sure." And then he said, "Do you think our weather is getting weirder?" And I said, "Well, yeah, actually, it is getting weirder. Our heat extremes are getting more frequent and more intense. Our heavy downpours are getting stronger with longer dry periods in between." And he looked at me, he said, "I knew it. I've lived here for 30 years, and I knew that something's changing."
That actually brings us to another point here, because there is a point where people, I mean, there's a lot of sort of initially a lot of sort of eyesight analysis or sort of like just sort of, well, I can feel something, I can see something, you know, look. We've seen the Trumpites do this stuff where they say, yeah, well, look, in this part of the country, it's just we're not having all that much. We're not having that too much rain or too little rain. We're actually getting enough rain. And, you know, there's things here and there. And there's always these things that they point to while they step back and basically use that to cover up what's really going on. And so I was thinking about this in terms of, well, go ahead and speak to that.
Oh, well, I was going to say, that's like saying, well, my great aunt Lulu smoked a pack of cigarettes a day and died at age 94. Without lung cancer. So that means that smoking can't cause lung cancer. You can always point to, you know, my grandpa ate bacon and eggs every day of his life. He died of pneumonia at age 86. So, you know, eating smoked meat and eggs is totally fine for your health. We could always cherry pick one little example to say, oh, just because this is happening means that cigarettes are good for you and bacon and eggs is the best thing you can eat every single day. But we know that when we look over large numbers of people who smoke, the risk of lung cancer go up significantly the more we smoke. And we know when we look around the entire world, as well as the United States, the risks that we humans face, risks to our health, risks to our agriculture, our water supply, even our energy infrastructure and our economy, by and large, the vast majority of those risks go up the further conditions move away from what we're used to. What's the perfect temperature for us humans? The temperature that we've had over the last couple of hundred and even thousand years that enabled us to develop this incredible way of life that we have today. But unfortunately, the reason why we have such a great lifestyle today is because we've built it on fossil fuels. And when we first started to do that back in the 1700s, we didn't know then that burning coal and gas and oil produces heat-trapping gases that are wrapping an extra blanket around our planet, causing it to run a fever. We didn't know that back then. But by the 1850s, we did. And by the 1890s, we knew how much the planet was going to warm if we kept on burning coal and gas and oil. And by the 1960s, enough scientists were sure about this to formally warn a U.S. president, Lyndon B. Johnson, of the dangers of a changing climate, not for polar bears, but for people. We care about a changing climate because it actually affects all of the things that we care about in the places where we live. It exacerbates all of the risks, the droughts, the floods, the crazy rains, even some of the crazy snowstorms they have on the East Coast, as well as the summer heat. It exacerbates many of these types of weather events that already have a negative and sometimes very expensive and even dangerous impact on us, and even more so on people in developing countries.
Now, tell us this. In some things that you've written about, you've talked about nasty surprises. And I wanted to find out from you, all right, what are these nasty surprises?
So why are we concerned about surprises? We're concerned because we have never been in this situation before. The amount of carbon that we are putting into the atmosphere that's wrapping this extra blanket around the planet, the amount of carbon we're putting into the atmosphere from burning coal and gas and oil, is about 10 times more every year than the most extreme example of natural climate change that we can find in the entire paleoclimate record going back 60, 80 million years. The planet has never gotten this much of a kick in the pants before. So we can make very, very educated guesses as to what's going to happen. And those educated guesses are even showing us what's already happening today. But when we look to the future, we have to say, wow, we have never seen this amount of carbon going into the atmosphere this quickly. And unfortunately, we scientists tend to be a bit on the conservative side. And so when we put out these reports, like this climate science report that we just wrote to the federal government that's under review right now, when we write these reports, we tend to be quite conservative in our estimates of what's going to happen in the future because we don't want to overstate it. We don't want to be alarmist like we're always accused of being. So we're conservative. But the reality is that if we look in the distant past at times when climate has changed naturally in the distant past before there was people on the planet, we see some very alarming things. We see conditions under which the Earth's climate abruptly shifts into a completely different state. Now, it's not anything as crazy as that movie The Day After Tomorrow where everything instantly freezes. It's not like that. But it's bad enough that the way we have, you know, two-thirds of our biggest cities within just a few feet of the sea level, what happens if Antarctica becomes destabilized and it melts so quickly that it just floods all of our cities, not overnight, but in a matter of years or even decades rather than centuries to millennia? What happens if we can no longer grow our crops and our food in the places where we used to? What happens if our water supplies dry up and entire areas become desertified, whereas other areas, it starts raining so much, everything just floods? So we are very concerned about the potential for surprises because we're conducting this experiment with the planet that has never been done before.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Catherine Hayhoe. Catherine is an atmospheric scientist who studies climate change, and she is one of the lead authors in the National Climate Assessment. This report is something that's mandated every 4 years by Congress, and the current report, as I said, is just about to be released, and there's been a lot of peer review, but there's also been a lot of uproar around this. It was recently published in the New York Times, which is really, really unusual for this report. So what happened and why has it become such a big deal, a massive battle in society?
It has. That's because over the past 10 years or so, climate change has become one of the most politicized topics in the entire United States. Today, the number one predictor of whether we think climate is changing and humans are responsible has nothing to do with how much we know about science. It has everything to do with where we fall on the political spectrum. The further to the right we fall, the more likely we are to completely reject the science on climate change, to say, it's not changing, it's just a hoax. Those scientists are making it up to line their pockets and to pave the way for a one-world government, as well as, you know, the Antichrist and all types of things like that, according to some of the Facebook comments and emails I get. So that actually, though, encapsulates the true root of the rejection of science. It isn't that people genuinely have a problem with the science, because the science that we use to study climate is the same science we use in our stoves every day or our airplanes. I mean, nobody really has a problem with those. The problem people have is not really with the science. It's with the solution. They feel that the perceived solutions that the government has to act on this and that by doing so, they are concerned that the government will take away their freedom. Now, let me emphasize, those are the perceived solutions. There are many real solutions that do not take away people's freedom. In fact, I think it even possibly increases people's freedom, especially if you're growing your own energy on your roof, for example, and plugging your own car into your own house rather than having to go to the pump to pay for it. Anyways, people don't like the solutions because they think that means the government would become too involved in not just people's lives, but too involved in industry and regulating industry. And so rather than say, well, it's a real problem, but I don't want to fix it, it's a lot more palatable to say, oh, those scientists aren't sure. They don't know yet. It could just be a natural cycle, or they fake the data. It's easier to come up with science-y-sounding excuses than to say, yes, it is real, but I don't want to do anything about it because of my political ideology. So that's the situation we're in today, and that is why this new climate science report that has already been thoroughly peer-reviewed by other scientists, by the public, by all relevant federal agencies, and by a special committee convened by the National Academy of Sciences for the sole purpose of reviewing this report. All of those peer reviews have already happened. It is in its final review by the administration, at which point previous such reports have only received primarily superficial comments back. And so if it was on schedule after this point, it would be, you know, just logistics to publication. But because climate change is such a politically polarized topic, that's why this report has become such a big deal.
Now, why did you guys decide to release this report, the National Climate Assessment? Why did you decide to release this report to the New York Times? Or somebody decided, not you necessarily, but somebody decided to release it for the actual release date. What was so important to get out there?
Yes. So as far as I know, we, in terms of the scientists who are the author team, did not release the report. Nobody knows who did, but none of us think it was us. So, but that said, though, let me backtrack a little bit. When the New York Times wrote their story and published the PDF of the report, which you can download from their website, it was based on the third draft, which was the draft that was already made available for public review in December. So since December, it's been publicly archived on internetarchive.org, and anybody could have gone and downloaded it and read it for themselves. Now, after they wrote the story, a day or two later, they then did get a hold of a fifth and final draft at that point. And the main difference between the third draft that went out in December and the fifth draft is the final draft is simply it includes our responses to the National Academy Review, which was, as you can imagine, very comprehensive, very thorough, and very helpful. So those are the differences between them, but when they first wrote the story, it was actually written about the published draft and only later updated to include the new draft, which they had to have gotten from somewhere, but that draft was available to hundreds of people. It was available to the administration, to agencies, as well as not just to the author team of the report, but the entire author team of all of the different aspects of the national assessment.
Now, when you're looking at that, then it gets released, and it's in the New York Times before the Trump regime has had an opportunity to actually sit back and say, okay, this is what we think of this. I understood that actually part of the thing, it may have been released to the Times because there was actually some worries about the Trump regime actually changing it.
That was actually the reason that the New York Times gave for writing their story. That was not what we were trying to get across. We, as the author team, felt that, as far as we know, and as far as we still know, the review was proceeding according to plan, and we were completely expecting to have the report reviewed or possibly reviewed with comments and then be on schedule for its November release. And so the story by the New York Times really kicked the hornet's nest on this one, and now your guess is honestly as good as mine as to which way this thing is going to go.
What I read was the idea was that there was actually a precedent to this idea of the Trump regime or the people reviewing it for the Trump regime, and I guess they have the final review or something on it, and if they were reviewing it, that they could actually change it, and that has been done before, for instance, under George W. Bush back years ago.
Yes, what they could do is they couldn't actually just take our report, change it, and then release it. What they could do is they could return it to the authors with a list of changes that they wanted to be made, which is a bit of a different thing. And then the authors review those changes and determine whether they're consistent with the science or not. But you're absolutely right. This happened before to government reports under the Bush administration. And so I'm sure that that was part of the concern that fueled both writing the story as well as whoever and whatever were discussing the situation beforehand.
Well, let's look at this in terms of what we've been talking about, this real threat. The Trump regime, they're actually doing some stuff around their position on climate and science. And I'd like you to compare and contrast a little bit, because these climate deniers that they've put out there, including Scott Pruitt, who's really big on, come on, this has nothing to do with reality. As you were saying in the beginning of this, it rained a lot 10 years ago. It's going to rain a lot now this year, and it's going to get hot and all this. They actually have a lot of things that they're putting out there that just aren't true, but that are building a basis. Well, basically, to be frank, their rape of the planet.
Yes. I mean, as a Christian, I am profoundly disturbed by the philosophy that we should just extract every last resource and benefit we can out of the planet and then push the eject button when we die. In Genesis 1, it talks specifically about how humans have stewardship or responsibility or even dominion over the planet. But if you even take the word dominion and look at a CEO who has dominion over a corporation, or you look at a ruler who has dominion over their land, what do you think of someone who just extracts every last penny out of their company or out of their land for short-term financial gain and then just leaves it in smoking ruins and walks away? We wouldn't respect an industry leader who did that. We wouldn't respect the ruler of a country who did that. And so for us to model that type of behavior and then to even use our faith as an excuse for that type of behavior, which enriches the few at the expense of the many, is one of the things that troubles me the most, not as a scientist, but as a human.
One last question. Because of your work overall, you have been targeted in the past by anti-science goons. Tell us about that and how you resolved it.
I am targeted every day, every single day. It might be on Twitter or on Facebook. It might be handwritten letters or emails. It might be blogs written on websites. Every single day, I am targeted with hate and some of the most negative things you can imagine. For one simple reason, it's because I and many of my colleagues are willing to stand up in the public sphere and say climate is changing, humans are responsible, the risks are dangerous, and we need to fix this.
Having said that, why do you think it is so contentious right now?
What makes this new climate science report so potentially contentious is because it isn't just a normal, regular, average report. It is a federal government report. And it is a federal government report that clearly contradicts many of the statements that we have heard people in the federal government making about climate change, that, oh, it isn't real, or it isn't changing, or the scientists fake the data, or we just don't know yet, and we should still be arguing over whether we even think something is real, when, again, the science stretches back to the 1800s, connecting burning coal, gas, and oil with carbon dioxide emissions with a warming planet. So why is it so contentious today? It's because the window of time to fix this thing is closing.
All right, Catherine Hayhoe, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And is there a place where people can, like, follow what you're doing?
Yes, my website is my name, CatherineHayhoe.com, but they can also find my Facebook page and my Twitter account.
All right, great. Thanks very much, Catherine.
Thank you.
All right, and real quick, I just want to let people know you can go to my Facebook page and find the information on how to contact Catherine pretty easily, all right? And so if you want to do that, do that. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Stephanie LaCombe, from a criminal defense attorney from Electronic Frontier Foundation. Stay tuned. I'm not satisfied, he's not satisfied, and you shouldn't be either, all right? That's what we got to start with. And if you're not satisfied, you got to do something about being not satisfied, all right? All right, back, you know, people remember a little while ago we had a representative of one of the defense, the support for the defendants in the J-20 case in Washington, D.C., the more than 200 people that were arrested during the Trump inauguration and the massive charges they were facing and all that other stuff that we went through on that, and we're still following it today. And it continues to grow and throw out even more. Each time you look at it, it gets even more just enraging, the kind of things that are being pulled up here. And just recently, the U.S. prosecutors have added a new outrage to the case, demanding information on countless numbers of people who have shown support or even interest in the J-20 defendants. And here to tell us about what's going on with this and what's happening here is my guest. And my guest is Stephanie LaCombe, for the criminal defense attorney from the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
So what the hell is going on with this, man? It's like it's just they go after these people. They're already facing like multitudes of lifetimes in behind bars if they get convicted. There's all kinds of stuff going on. More than 200 people on trial. What is this new thing that's developed?
Well, the U.S. Attorney's Office served Dream Host with a search warrant for all information regarding any communication with the Disrupt J-20 website. DreamHost had received a subpoena for subscriber information for the people that had registered and run the website earlier in, I think, January or February, and had responded. But this search warrant seeks all information and communication with the website. So anyone who had clicked on the website and, you know, looked at content there, it could be a journalist, it could be someone with a passing interest, it could be someone who was listening to your show right now and decided to look it up on Google. So the DreamHost lawyers decided to go to the government and say, you know, hey, this seems really overbroad. Would you like to narrow the scope of what you're asking for? Because it doesn't seem like this could possibly be appropriate. And the DOJ responded by filing a motion to compel them to comply. And I believe the estimate is approximately 1.3 million users' information would be covered by this sweeping warrant. And so DreamHost did what we have applauded them for doing, standing up for their users and telling the DOJ, no, we're going to fight you in court about this because we don't think this is legal.
Now, is this kind of unprecedented, this idea of going after something like DreamHost and saying, okay, we want the names or we want the information about all the people who've gone onto this website? Like, for instance, do you think they've done it to all those Nazi websites?
Well, I don't know that there are other investigations pending. I mean, ostensibly, we are left to infer that this is in relation to the J20 prosecutions or somehow connected to that. I can't speak to what the DOJ, if they have or will be doing the same kind of thing in other cases. But I think why people are so concerned about this and why it is concerning is that, you know, there is a political shade to this that people are worried about because, you know, if our government can, with a single warrant, get information on all people who choose to exercise constitutionally protected activity, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom to ask for redress from your government, and freedom to access information, all of those rights, you have the right to do that so anonymously, it will have very chilling effects for the exercise of these constitutionally protected rights. I mean, people hearing about this are going to wonder, well, you know, do I want to really check out or access information from particular websites if that means I'm going to be on some government list somewhere down the line?
Mm-hmm. Now, what does this do in relation to the Fourth Amendment?
Well, I think there are the Fourth Amendment was enshrined by the founders of our country to protect us against general warrants. General warrants from the British was basically like if, you know, they were looking for someone in a particular city, they would just go house to house looking for them regardless of having any reason to believe that they would be in any of those houses. Our founding fathers understood that we wanted to protect citizens from that kind of oversweeping power grab by the government. That's why we have the Fourth Amendment that is supposed to protect us from unreasonable searches and seizures. And one of the pillars of that protection is that the government can't do that without a warrant based on probable cause, that there has to be the judiciary actually acts as a stopgap, as a balancing power against the executive's power to say that, you know, you actually have to articulate with sufficient particularity what it is you're looking for and where you're looking for it. And that you have a reason, you have probable cause to believe that you will find what you're looking for where you want to look for it. And I think that's the analysis that has become harder and harder for the judiciary to grapple with when it's in the digital space. Because I think, you know, both the law and judges are trying to catch up with technology as it develops and understanding, you know, what it is that the government's really asking for when they're saying, you know, all communications to a particular website, you know, the government will argue that it all has to do with the Disrupt J20, you know, what they're trying to call a riot instead of a protest. But what I think the defense and what DreamHost is trying to unpack for the judge is that, well, really, if you enforce this warrant the way the government wants you to enforce it, you're not just going to, there's no temporal limit. You know, it's everyone who has communicated with the website before the protest and after the protest. So there's an argument that, you know, if you were to click on it now, if your listeners were to go to Disrupt J20 right now, that their information could also be pulled up as a part of this warrant. That's why it's not sufficiently particular. That's why it fails in being able to provide for the Fourth Amendment protections and why it shouldn't be enforced the way the government wants it to be enforced.
Mm-hmm. Of course, this is the Department of Justice under, what's his name again? What's that little guy's name again? Sessions. Yeah. Right. That's sort of the miniature Nazi. Here's one last question. It'll be real quick because I'm just looking at this and it says, but basically what they're gathering is a list of everyone who's been interested in attending the protests or seeing what was going on in the protests. And that's the troubling aspect. This is a quote from somebody from Electronic Frontiers Foundation. And it says basically that there's a point here where if you're looking for these, what they expect is to get IP addresses. And if you're getting an IP address, that doesn't necessarily uniquely identify users, but there is a way that that can actually turn up people's individual names, right? It's not that hard to go from an IP address to somebody's identity, right?
Well, we do have a white paper on explaining why an IP address isn't necessarily always going to correlate with a particular identity, but there certainly are a number of methods that you can, investigative methods you can take for trying to connect an IP address with a specific user. But it's a little more complicated than that, but it certainly is a lot. Personally identifying information will be connected to that IP address. And they are actually asking for a lot of, in the opposition that DreamHost filed, they identify a slew of other kind of ancillary pieces of information that the government's actually asking along with the IP addresses, the IP logs.
Mm-hmm. All right, Stephanie, unfortunately we're running out of time, but we'll have to have you back to continue this. We'll follow this, okay? All right.
Okay.
So thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank
Thanks.
You.
Bye now. All right. We've just been talking with Stephanie Lacombe, from the criminal defense attorney from the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. And we've been talking about the prosecution of the Inauguration Day or J-20 defendants, the people arrested for protesting at the inauguration of Trump, and the unconstitutional methods that the prosecution is using to pursue them in court. All right. We're going to end here. It's unfortunately we have to end. I really wanted to keep on going, but we are going to end. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank Carl Dix, representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-initiator of Refuse Fascism. And let me tell you, you can find out a whole hell of a lot more of what you need to know about what's going on today at refusefascism.org. So go there now, right away. Go there. Keep going back there. I also want to thank climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe and Stephanie Lacombe from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which you can find out more about at EFF.org. All right, once again, that's EFF.org. And as I said before, and I will continue to say each and every week, you can find links to websites, names of books and movies and anything else that you hear mentioned on my show on my Facebook page. And once again, let me say this again. Go to refusefascism.org. Sisters and brothers, these are dangerous times. They're times that actually require people to change what they're doing with their lives, require us to make an assessment of what we're going to allow and accept and what we're going to turn up against and stand up against. So keep going to refusefascism.org. Find a way to plug in. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Teddy Robinson is back. Yeah. Hey, how you doing, Teddy? Good. Say hi. All right, man. And I want to let you know that we're going to be back again next week. And remember, these are hard times, but we got to fight for it. We got to fight for what's going on. All right. You got to stand up. You got to recognize what's happening. And then you got to make your decision about what the hell you're going to do in the face of a monster. All right. That's what you got to do. All right. And we'll talk to you again next week. Now I can't pledge allegiance to your flag, 'cause I can't find no reconciliation with your past. When there was nothing equal for my people in your math, you forced us in the ghetto, and then you took our dads. The belly of the beast, these streets are demons' abs. I'm telling you that setup in them sit-ups is so sad. The system is a slab, corruption is the swanger. Sitting high, riding dirty, drag racing in the danger. And it's so clean, pine trees smelling good. We work off in the trunk, and niggas in the...